as a single on a record player.
Soon as Lanza comes on, Lanza, such a distinctive voice.
The walls are literally shaking. It's just unassailably powerful.
Mario Lanza looked like and sounded like a god.
To sell a million records, that's a massive thing.
I still get the same thrill hearing those records.
The Italian people think that Mario is unique.
Pretty much as close, technically perfect as he can be.
He referred to his voice as the voice. The voice owns me, I don't own the voice. He always felt it was from God.
Now, I'd like to sing for you, if I may, the loveliest night of the year, since for me it is.
Black and white film of Lanza in front of a microphone.
When you are in love,
Lanza had a sway and a swagger to his voice.
He was his toughest critic. So if he felt that his voice wasn't right, he would not sing in concert.
In airports or in hotels or in opera houses, he got mobbed.
Mario's on a coach. Female fans are pressed against the window.
Not only was he the rock and roll star of the day, he lived the rock and roll lifestyle.
My father loved people to be around him.
He'd take his big entourage with him, and then in the evening the drinking would ensue. He did at one point become renowned for being unreliable.
Mario went literally in a matter of months from being bankable to unemployable.
He brought all that fabulous burnished Italianate tenor sound to the simplest piece of music.
Incredible. The high C, so powerful. Nobody compared to Mario.
He gave everything to music. And I suppose it took everything from him in the end as well.
Mario Lanza died in 1959 at the age of 38. He was the forefather of the rock and roll deaths.
After 57 years, we're still here, sitting down, talking about a great man who was a really fantastic singer.
The letters of the name Lanza are dotted with bulbs which light up. There's a photo of Lanza in a tux, singing. In curly letters it says, "The best of everything." Derek Mannering, official biographer.
At the close of Mario's weekly radio show, he would sign off by wishing his listeners the very best of everything in life always. That beautiful sentiment summed up all that he represented. The best of times, the very best of everything.
Mario Lanza was born Alfred Arnold Cocozza, Freddy for short, on the 31st of January 1921. Both of Freddy's parents had traveled to America as Italian emigrants, with Tony Cocozza falling in love with Maria while she was helping out in the family store. The couple married and soon after had Freddie.
They were very strict Catholic and they were very proud to be Americans.
My father was a great World War I hero. My father actually was the first man to capture what in those days they called a Boche prisoner in the Battle of the Aragon Forest.
My grandfather was wounded in World War I. He had been gassed and shot in the arm and the back. So he had always been on disability.
My mother worked very hard. She used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and be at work by 6. Imagine that. And come home at 6 in the evening. Long, long hours, you see. And so therefore you can very well see how Pop had to take care of Freddie. They used to call me Freddie. They never called me Mario.
Freddie grew up in a home filled with song. His lullabies were the arias of Verdi and Puccini, sung by the great operatic voices of the day, such as Caruso.
A photo of a smiling man in a jester's costume banging a drum.
My father loved listening to them. He used to listen to them over and over again.
I was an altar boy in church, and when I had free moments, I used to go out and sit in the church and look at the altar, look at the little red light above the altar with the flame flickering, and I used to be fascinated by the flame and get lost in thought. And in that, let's say, being lost in thought, I had great visions, visions of what was to come in the future. And the odd part of all that I spoke about is that I saw my career happen long before it actually did.
How old were you at the time?
All of nine.
All of nine?
An impromptu sing-along one day to Caruso's recording of Vesti la Giuba convinced his parents that their boy had talent.
It surprised my grandparents because they didn't know that he had the voice that he had. He knew he wanted to sing.
Hands strike piano keys. A portrait of the smartly dressed, dark-haired young tenor.
My mother realized that at that time I needed all these lessons so badly to lay the foundation for a career in the future.
She knew this was a spectacular voice. Maybe not Caruso, but a great voice. She took on an extra job and worked long, long hours, and Mario never forgot that.
It's astounding to me when I review the past how many sacrifices my mother and father made.
Freddy Cocozza eventually studied with celebrated voice coach Irene Williams, who guided her young charge towards an audition with the conductor, Sergei Koussevitzky.
Irene Williams felt that if Koussevitzky could hear Mario sing, it might lead to something.
I started to sing what I call my lucky aria, and that is Vesti la Giuba from Pagliacci. When I finished the aria, he said, "You will come to live with me in the Berkshire Festival." And then he kissed me on both cheeks. I realized at the moment that something terrific was happening.
Koussevitzky famously said, "Caruso redivivus, Caruso reborn."
After Koussevitzky heard him sing, Alfred Cocozza ended up with a scholarship at Tanglewood, Massachusetts. But before the young tenor headed to Tanglewood, he paid a tribute to his mother by adopting the masculine version of her maiden name to become Mario Lanza.
Tanglewood was the summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and they would have concerts there. And Mario technically made his operatic debut as Fenton in The Merry Wives of Windsor.
The following day, in headlines in the New York Times, appeared Mario Lanza, born to sing.
I went home, and what do you think I found? A letter from Uncle Sam. I was in the Army.
He hated the Army, absolutely hated it. And he was stationed in Marfa in Texas, and his voice dried out because of all the heat and the sand. Then Peter Lind Hayes, an impresario, was looking for singers for a production of On the Beam, and Mario wanted to audition for him, but his voice was shot, so he took a record of a tenor from the Metropolitan Opera House, I think it was Frederick Jaegel, singing Ya Luce Van La Stella, and he put his name on it.
When he sang, they said to him, "Oh my God, this is far better than the record you sent us." Which just shows you his presence and charisma.
And what followed was Winged Victory, written by Moss Hart. And that was a huge success, but Mario was only in the chorus. And eventually it went to Hollywood, where they decided to film it. Mario was absent for some of the rehearsals. He was getting a taste of the high life even then. And he was actually fired from the production. And that's when Sam Weiler, who became his manager, stepped in and upped the game and got him to study with Enrico Rosati.
Rosati, who actually was his teacher from then on, who really helped him work on his repertoire, helped him work on his breathing.
Rosati said, "You know, I've waited 34 years for you since Gigli, of a voice blessed by God."
Photos of Lanza in a white Navy uniform.
If you look at the pictures in those early days, Mario was not movie star handsome. He was really heavy. But then he started to lose the weight. One of the great blessings of Mario Lanza's life did come through his time in the Army. Close friend in the Army was a guy named Bert Hicks. And Bert had a beautiful sister named Betty. So when they were in California, Bert introduced Mario to Betty Lanza, and it was love at first sight.
In life, to have a partner, a true, lovable, wonderful partner, is so important. And aren't I the luckiest guy in the world because I met a wonderful partner.
I met Mario through my brother.
Uh-huh. They were in the army together.
I see.
And brought him home to dinner, and that's how it started.
There it is.
As simple as that. Not much, but it's not very complicated. No, her brother and myself, we were great army buddies, and he used to show me the picture. He used to show me the picture of a very beautiful girl. He used to say, Mario, he used to say, isn't that a beautiful girl? Uh-huh. And I say, my goodness, yes. Uh-huh. He never told me it was a sister.
My father and mother were married in 1945, April 13th, at Beverly Hills City Hall. They had no money. They were just starting out in life. And he brought her a little ring, a little silver ring, and she always wore it. And I have it today.
He was basically an Italian husband, and she was part Irish. Her family came from Ireland. And, you know, that was a volatile mix at times. But she was always there for him, and she never ever let him down, and she loved him with a deep, deep passion.
After 45, I got back in the swing of things, and one night I sang, and the reviews that I got were so sensational that out in Hollywood, an old friend of mine presented these reviews to the people at MGM, and the following day, they signed me.
While Mario was preparing to make his first movie, he also made two performances of Pinkerton in Madama Butterfly.
A young woman looks at a program in a theatre box.
That was the only time he would grace the opera stage in a full-length production. He was constantly being compared to the true operatic giants of his day, people like Jussi Björling, Giuseppe Di Stefano, Richard Tucker, to understand why almost 60 years later he's still revered while these truly great opera singers are in the history books. You have to go back to what happened when Mario was discovered by MGM.
Supremo Louis B. Mayer described his new singing discovery as Clark Gable with a voice. The comparison to a Hollywood legend who lived life to the full was prescient.
Between him and his father, they could sit and eat 15 pounds of steak in one sitting. And so in a weekend, he could put on, you know, 16, 17 pounds in weight.
He'd been in the army, he was very depressed. He didn't pay much attention to his weight.
By the time he reported to MGM to embark on his movie career, he had packed on over 20 pounds. In a move that would have far-reaching consequences for Lanza, Louis B. Mayer turned to MGM's Mr. Fitness, Terry Robinson, to get him into shape. So when filming began on Lanza's first film, That Midnight Kiss, co-starring MGM's singing star Catherine Grayson, Lanza was well on his way to his target weight. And Lanza's friendship with Terry Robinson would last well beyond his own lifetime.
They became fast friends, and my Uncle Terry took off 25 pounds from my dad.
Many years later, Peter Herman Adler would look back on Lanza's career and say, 10 years with the right opera company and no one could touch him. But after being a star, how could he go back to learning? Mario Lanza was about to become one of the biggest stars in the world.
That Midnight Kiss saw Lanza singing an eclectic mix, but it was Lanza's spirited rendition of Celeste Aida that caused a sensation.
They're all touched by this extraordinary tone that made the hair go up at the back, as it did all of us, and made us feel, oh my God, who is this?
He sings it to the manner born, as confident and as secure and as thrilling as a great opera singer would do. But also in that film, he sang Jerome Kern's beautiful They Didn't Believe Me, and he sang it in a soft, croony fashion with exquisite, sensuous phrasing that would recall Sinatra at his best.
There's a photo of Lanza standing singing by a piano, then a black and white clip of Lanza lifting his female co-star off a bench and spinning her round.
And people sat back and said, what is this? This man, on the one moment, is singing a great aria, so he must be an opera singer. But he's also crooning, "They Didn't Believe Me." And this is amazing.
His charisma, especially when you watch his movies, very in your face in a good way. He jumps almost off the screen of the television set to sing for you. He had this special star quality, which is very rare indeed.
Lanza is standing at a microphone wearing a dark suit and buttoned up collar. He scratches his ear.
You're certainly terrific. And thank thank you very much.
They often talk about animal magnetism. It's there on the screen.
And I don't think anybody like that had come along in a long time. People admired Enrico Caruso for his voice, which was beautiful, but he wasn't handsome.
Kind of looked like your dad, didn't they? Whereas Mario Lanza looked like and sounded like a god.
There's a series of black and white portrait photos of Lanza.
Lanza was, without any shadow of a doubt, the first, as Pavarotti called him, mediatic tenor.
He showed that you can act in a modern way while singing opera.
He was the first one who was an extremely handsome man, who could act, and had an amazing voice. He was a triple threat.
Mario Lanza's Hollywood success cemented his growing reputation as a recording artist. And 4 years after first signing with RCA Victor, Lanza laid down four tracks at New York's Manhattan Center on May the 5th, 1949.
For that first session, he recorded two arias and two Neapolitan songs. All four recordings were done in a single take. It's like he blossomed overnight.
The first major success of his recording career was with a song specially written for his next picture, The Toast of New Orleans. Lanza was again teamed with Catherine Grayson, but this time it was the tenor's name who headed the cast.
The film closes with a lengthy duet from Madama Butterfly, the opera in which he sang in New Orleans. And you cannot take your eyes off Lanza when he's singing. Moviegoers had never seen anything like this. It was raw, it was visceral, and as much as the purists may have hated it, it was very, very sexy.
It was a romantic ballad, Be My Love, that propelled Mario Lanza from singer to music legend. And it became his signature tune for the rest of his life.
Be My Love is fantastic. I listened many tenors that in his honor sang Be My Love, but nobody compared to Mario.
He adored Catherine and she adored him. They were like brothers and sisters, and they used to compete to get the high, to see who could get reach the highest note.
Is legato, you know, be my love, all the phrase powerful, and at the end high C is impossible.
The tenor's RCA recording of Be My Love, conducted by Frank Sinatra's cousin Ray Sinatra, went on to sell over 1 million copies, giving Lanza his first gold record.
No one really understood Mario's unique gift to sing not just opera but popular music.
He had this fantastic classical trained voice, but he put a pop inflection. He made classical music his own. He made it popular.
Although he didn't realize it at the time, Mario was not going to follow Caruso's path on the opera stage. He was going to be forever known, what we call today, a crossover singer, but the ultimate crossover singer.
Someone who was equally at home in pop music, but at the same time had this magnificent ability to sing opera.
You can hear Lanza on the radio, and sometimes, you know, I might be thinking, is that is that Pavarotti? Is it Domingo? Is it Jussi Björling? You know, listen for a bit and go, oh, it's Pavarotti, you know, certain nuances. Soon as Lanza comes on, Lanza, such a distinctive voice.
There's an old-fashioned radio, next to which is a coffee cup and a copy of Time magazine with Lanza on the cover.
He had a purity of sound and a purity of heart that enabled the listener to go directly to the core of the music.
The thing that makes icons, that makes Elvis, that makes Mario Lanza, that makes David Bowie, is the fact that they are all crossover artists. So you've got Mario Lanza with the ability to be able to sing opera and be able to sing pop. You've got Elvis, who shows his operatic chops on It's Now or Never.
He's just developed this beautiful sound in his voice based on using more of his mask, more of a forward sound as opposed to the inner, more depth sound in a tenor voice.
It had a pop lilt to it. You know, overhead the moon is beaming. So he's in a completely different placement of the voice, more towards the soft palate and a lot more forward and a lot warmer and rounder and smoother and more airy.
A single plays on a jukebox.
A voice that's not placed very forward in the mask is normally sweeter. Because it's what we call covered. It's back. But when it's placed in the mask, it's normally brisker and brighter. Mario had this incredible ability to mask that or make it sound so sweet.
He had taken that sound and made it into art, he had developed his own artistry.
I show pupils who are pop singers, they've got record deals with me, and I show them Mario, and they look at that and they go, they sit there and watch him, they go, how does he do that?
Mario Lanza had a full lyric voice, very strong and bright, with a squillo.
That was the quality you heard in his singing, that wonderful natural openness, that glorious timbre, that sound, which had testosterone underneath it, like you can't imagine.
I only know for as long as I may live, I'll only live.
It's just unassailably powerful. He was a man who could sing into the middle of the floor and the voice would just get louder and louder and the room becomes his amplifier.
It was kind of like, oh, and then wow. That's what he had.
He had a big voice, like Pavarotti, like a big Caruso, too. He had a sun in the voice, unique.
Mario Lanza's voice has that kind of burnished gold, with a timbre that is almost impossible to imitate or to replicate.
He had a mix in his voice from what I would call the chest to the pharynx, a sort of and it hold that note in a specific way, which made it, wow, how did he do that?
We're looking for that transcendent note that's superhuman, and Mario Lanza had that in droves.
He probably breathed through his nose more, so it's in. It's like, it's in. It's in.
He had, as a good technique, as one can have. The registers were equal, the lower voice was beautiful, the middle even more so, with a trilling top. That's pretty much what technique gives you.
Not only has it sort of informed my idea of the perfect voice in a classical sense, but also that idea of sustain and power. And it's there when I play rock guitar. That's what I'm looking for.
His way of singing, when it was captured right, and when he was on form, is, I think, second to none.
Ave Maria, gratia plena.
The first time I saw and heard Mario Lanza sing was when my 80-year-old Irish grandmother took me to see The Great Caruso in a little cinema in Dublin.
The idea of filming the life and times of The Great Caruso had been floating around Hollywood for decades. When Lanza burst onto the scene, the search for a celluloid Caruso was finally over.
The colorful life and times of the fabulous Caruso spring to life.
To his undying credit, Louis B. Mayer, who had discovered Mario Lanza for the movies, had such faith and confidence in him, he gave it the go-ahead, the green light.
How does it feel to be chosen to do the life of Caruso? That must be something that every tenor dreams of.
Well, it really is. I guess it is every tenor's dream. Or even baritones, maybe. I don't know. Basses, everybody, sopranos.
Inspired by the opportunity to portray his idol on screen, Lanza invited artists from the Metropolitan Opera Company to join him in the operatic excerpts.
It became Mario Lanza's greatest moment on the screen, a landmark motion picture, a movie that influenced the career of an entire generation of future operatic greats.
The movie, The Great Caruso, was in television. And I was 10 years old and was completely enchanted by this bright, light voice of Mario. And I thought, wow, an Italian in Hollywood.
I was born in 78, so age of 13, we're talking about heavy metal, you know, Metallica, Iron Maiden. And my uncle, who was tired from all this kind of music, he said, can you give the devil's music a break, as he used to call it, and listen to this guy? And he pushed in the VHS, the running credits of The Great Caruso came up. The minute he opened his mouth, I immediately said, this is the most beautiful sound a man can make with his throat.
The Great Caruso became one of the top grossing pictures at the box office for 1951. And from then on, the names of Lanza and Caruso became forever entwined.
For Lanza, the inspiration was Caruso. His incredible power and command over the voice.
Enrico Caruso had a very humble feeling about his voice. He believed that it had been bestowed upon him by God as a gift which he was to use to give happiness and delight to others. He said that was what his name meant, Caruso, which is Italian for a dear use.
Mario was like Caruso, a full voice tenor. The difference is that Mario was a great actor.
Caruso sang technically, absolutely brilliantly, but Lanza had a sway and a swagger to his voice.
This is a quote from Enrico Jr. Caruso on Mario Lanza. Vocally and musically, the great Caruso has helped many young people discover opera and even become singers themselves. He added that, I can think of no other tenor before or since Mario Lanza who could have risen with comparable success to the challenge of playing Caruso.
He's dressed in doublet and hose on a stage.
Mario Lanza excelled in both the classical and the light popular repertory, an accomplishment that was beyond even my father's exceptional talents.
With the success of The Great Caruso breaking box office records all over the world, Mario was thrilled in one particular sense because he was bringing opera, his great passion, to the world, and maybe just quieting the voices who were saying, why don't you sing opera full time? Because he was now able to say, look, I'm bringing opera to millions of people who might otherwise have never heard these great arias.
He's the only one that bring the art, Italian art quality, like opera, into the Hollywood world.
My job was to bring, as an obligation to the public, since I was simply and wholly the keeper of a gift, right? Mm-hmm. My job was to bring, let's say, greater beauty to the world mm-hmm. in my own little way.
There's a scene in The Great Caruso where he sings Gigella da Manina from La Bohème, and it's just an excerpt from it, but it opens with a high shot of Mimi sitting at this table, and Mario as Rodolfo starting to move around it. And he's singing, and gloriously singing this beautiful aria.
It's just absolutely beautiful and heartbreaking, and there's no sense of anything sentimental in there. It's just, he moves you to tears.
Gigella da Manina in The Great Caruso was one of the best performances of that aria that I have ever heard.
You think about the lyric, you know, your tiny hand is frozen, let me warm it for you. And when you watch it, you realize that this Rodolfo wants to warm up a lot more than her tiny little hand.
He stands behind his female co-star, who remains seated.
To moviegoers, they're looking and thinking, this is incredible. The music is glorious, his voice is spectacular, and yes, it's really very sexy.
The film's success ignited his recording career, and RCA quickly released an accompanying album of arias. The Great Caruso went on to become the first operatic LP to sell over 1 million copies.
To sell 1 million records? That's a massive thing. There is your evidence of Mario Lanza being a phenomenal opera singer.
His subsequent recording of The Loveliest Night of the Year also gave Lanza another gold disc.
It's the loveliest night of the year, waltzing along in the blue.
Retrospectively, Lanza could probably be considered as the first crossover artist because he was probably the first artist of his time, classically trained opera singer, that transcended from opera into the world of movies, and then the movies obviously generating incredible record sales.
My heart starts to beat like a child when a birthday is near. So kiss me, my sweet. Night of the year.
He had the perfect combination of good looks and a great voice.
Operatic singing still was very, very popular, much more mainstream than it is today. So obviously where he went, in airports or in hotels or opera houses, he got mobbed. Like the case of Maria Callas, they weren't opera singers, they were global superstars.
And what was surprising at the time was that all the Bobby Soxers of that era, they fell in love with him.
The idealized male, as personified by the poet, the singer, the artist, the actor.
A young girl would be very attracted to this powerful, manly voice.
He was the pop idol of the early 50s. He was the singer that all the girls screamed after.
Young women used to throw him their knickers, their underwear on stage, and which was quite funny. I remember that because my family were all bookworms, and they kept all these, Time magazine and Reader's Digest and National Geographic.
It's the loveliest.
for a singer to make their vulnerability their strength, I think is all important, because you've got to be able to reach people. You've got to be able to produce joy and tears. And if you can do that as a singer, and Mario Lanza certainly could, then you are there.
He stands at a mic.
When he sang, he believed every word of that song, and he gave it his all. Some critics would say, oh, he overdoes it, or he over-sings, why does he need to hit all those high notes? But that was who my father was. That was truly Mario Lanza.
The brightest star I see looks down my love and envies me, because you're mine, because you're mine, because you're mine. The breeze that hurries by becomes a melody. And why? Because you're mine.
He appealed to everyone in the family. If you compare it with the Rolling Stones, Elvis Presley, the Sex Pistols, it's always the mother didn't like it, or the daughter don't like it, or the grandmother didn't like it. But with Mario, everyone loved him.
Lanza was the rock and roll star of the day, and not only was he the rock and roll star of the day, he lived the rock and roll lifestyle.
If you look at Elvis or all the great rock and rollers, they overdo it with the food, they overdo it with the drink, they overdo it with whatever. And I think he was probably one of the first opera performers to come into a rock and roll vibration.
When he would get into hotel suites or wherever he was going, he'd take his big entourage with him, and then in the evening the drinking would ensue, and he was the type of person that would easily get addicted to food, drink, whatever it might be.
You have to understand, this is a man still like in his 20s, his late 20s, with success unheard of.
Discussions were soon underway at MGM for Lanza to follow the success of The Great Caruso with The Student Prince, but development delays prompted MGM instead to push ahead with Because You're Mine.
It wasn't the best written screenplay imaginable, and Mario didn't like it at all. But he was contracted to do it, and he went ahead and filmed it.
The caption says, Lanza sings again.
Filming started in May 1951, with its star at his heaviest ever on-screen weight. But by the time shooting was completed in February 1952, the singer was an astonishing 6.5 stone lighter.
When Mario would make a movie, he liked to pre-record songs at a certain weight, a heavy weight. You can see certain scenes where he's super thin and he's kind of large.
When it comes to physical size, there is fat and then there is fat. In the sense that you know, weight fluctuation is something that I as well had issue with, at much lesser degree than Mario Lanza.
He took on board the 18th century concept that a lot of opera singers did, that being big and fat is where it's at.
In the case of Mario, it was more a case of personal life that caused, you know, this eating irregularities.
He would go on a crash diet, a crazy mad crash diet, like losing 80 pounds when he was filming Because You're Mine. I mean, that's ruinous to your health.
With filming due to commence on The Student Prince, Lanza and his musical director, Konstantin Kalinikos, set about pre-recording the selections chosen for the picture. But before a single scene had been shot, Lanza fell into disagreement with the film's director, Curtis Bernhardt.
Bernhardt made a suggestion that Mario's recording of Beloved was a little too sexy. He pours out his love for the servant girl Kathy, Beloved, with all my heart, I love you. And of course, Mario looked at the lyrics and said, I'm going to give it my all.
A sound engineer sits in front of 50 sound equipment, sliding switches and turning knobs.
But Curtis Bernhardt said, no, you don't really need to give it all. You're a Prussian prince. You gradually open yourself to this woman.
Every word he sang, he meant. So I think when he was directed to tone it down a bit, because he was this Prussian prince, he rebelled.
Mario just exploded, because the tensions were there with MGM. And he felt, you can criticize my acting, but don't even think about criticizing my singing.
He felt that the words and the meaning had to be conveyed in this very, very dramatic way to convince this woman, you know, that he loved her.
Matters were not helped by the steely resolve of Mayer's successor at MGM, Dori Shari.
Mr. Mayer and my father had a great relationship. And when Dori Shari came into power, they did not agree on anything. And that was one of the big problems.
If Mayer was a showman, Shari was an intellectual. And Shari, aware of cost overruns on the Carter mine, knew that Mario was what you might term temperamental.
If management were not supporting him with the right language, the right feeling of we're on your side, we're all going in the same direction, all singing from the same hymn sheet, let's get going, that would have caused a lot of problems in the artists, and it always does.
Despite the best efforts of family and friends, Lanza walked off set and refused to return until Bernhardt was replaced.
Shari said, you can't have this, you know, this Curtis Bernhardt is a solid, you know, company director, and, you know, he's going to stay in the picture.
You're looking at the head of a studio, and you're looking at a big star. If one doesn't back down and the other doesn't back down, that's it. You've got a stalemate.
His trainer, Terry Robinson, went for a meeting with Dori Shari, and they said, look, we've got to get you guys working together again. So Shari called Mario in. They had a meeting. Voices were raised. Mario stormed out, slammed the door, and never returned.
He's standing at a microphone again.
MGM promptly sued Lanza for millions of dollars for defaulting on his contract and prevented him from recording for RCA while the dispute was pending.
The original contract said he could do 6 months of movies and 6 months of concerts. And that was wonderful. But when this problem came, he could do nothing. He still was Mario Lanza. But Mario Lanza was not working. And that depressed him quite a bit. And he went into a very deep depression.
By completely cutting off his income, MGM hoped to bring Lanza to his senses. But it simply made an increasingly embittered singer become even more entrenched.
With the trouble caused on the set of The Student Prince, Mario went literally in a matter of months from being bankable to unemployable.
He lost his income. He had four children, his wife, my mother. And I think the entire situation was very, very negative for him.
Lanza's legal problems with MGM were finally resolved when the singer agreed to permit the company to use his singing voice while Edmund Purdom mimed to the great recordings.
This is where kind of the slightly tragic irony comes in. Curtis Bernhardt had moved on to another production, leaving the film to be eventually directed by Richard Thorpe, who had directed The Great Caruso and had worked so wonderfully well with Mario. The double irony in all of this story is that Mario did re-record A Love It. And in my humble opinion, the second recording really was better than the first one.
The Student Prince was eventually released in 1954. Lanza reportedly never saw the finished production.
During that crazy time, Mario had a manager, Sam Weiler, and Sam Weiler had heard Mario sing when he was virtually unknown. And he offered to help fund him and develop his career. Once the money started to flow in, Sam was delighted, and Mario was delighted, but Sam invested a lot of his money, and he lost a lot of his money. And sadly, they had a really bad and kind of nasty breakup.
He had two sets of books, one for my father and one for himself. So when his books were on the wrong side, he would put it over to my father's side.
He had a court case with Sam Wyler, but Wyler walked away with a nice share of Mario's future earnings.
Filled with a deep sense of betrayal, Lanza retreated from public view. Hollywood had seen its share of career declines, but few had fallen as spectacularly as Lanza's.
I believe the problems with him, because he was an innocent man in so many ways, started with the agents, with the people who wanted a piece of him. And believe me, he gave a piece of him away to almost everyone.
Singers are very open-hearted, they're very trusting, but that also makes you very vulnerable. And my sense is that he was just that, and that a lot of the people around him really took advantage of him.
An example of my father's trust of people began very early with Irene Williams. He was off to New York, and at the train station she handed him a contract, and it gave her 5%. And this is before he ever earned any money. It gave her 5% under $5,000, and then it went up to 10%, and then eventually 20%. And that was a contract that he regretted signing.
As his money started to dwindle, Mario really knew that he had to get back on his feet. So enter Al Teitelbaum, who was his second manager. And Al was a furrier in Los Angeles, the furrier to the stars.
And this man decided that he would take care of my father and he would get him concerts and became his manager. He also took quite a large percentage.
A statement has been made to the effect that Mr. Teitelbaum's affairs, his financial affairs, were in bad shape.
When we moved to Rome, there was a very large tax burden on my father because this manager had not paid any taxes.
Toxic people have no place around an opera singer. This environment can become enough toxic by itself without you adding to it.
Teitelbaum informs me that his assets, liquid assets, including inventory, cash in bank, and accounts receivable far exceeded any and all of his liabilities. Is that correct, Mr. Teitelbaum?
That's absolutely true.
Yes.
And those types of things really broke my father's heart, just terribly disappointed him in humanity.
His voice was the thing that got him the stardom and got him everywhere. The voice himself, his own voice. But who he is, I think, got left behind a little bit.
He referred to his voice as the voice. You know, the voice owns me, I don't own the voice. The voice has to be here, whether I want to or not.
He realized that when he went to a party and there was a piano and the host would ask him to sing, that they only really wanted the voice.
Hello, Mario, how are you? Please come in and we have a piano here and what would you like to sing? So sometimes he would say, you know, I thought you invited me. I didn't come to sing.
People don't realize how precious it is, that in a noisy, smoky atmosphere as it would have been then, you know, you can harm your voice.
There would have been a bit of depression in him based on the fact that he as a person wasn't as loved as much as his voice was loved. And everybody was expecting him to have a relationship with just his voice, not himself.
He felt overbearing. It was overbearing, this thing.
When you work with someone's voice, you can hear in their voice their disappointment.
It wasn't in his makeup, in his being, to be idolized, to be so famous. I don't know if he ever did understand what it meant. It's a very, very double-edged sword.
Lanza was probably the most famous star at that particular moment in time on the planet. And fame can go to your head with the character that he was. It was a disastrous combination.
was a selection of black and white photos. He's with smiling fans, then a grinning man standing holding a birthday cake behind him. There's a photo of him with his arm round his wife. Now Mario is singing with another man, pressing his belly.
His sound for me is just full of family and love and sunlight and good living.
There's black and white film of Rome in the 50s. The Roman Forum is shown and the Trevi Fountains, where water pours off a rock into the basin. Someone throws a coin into the water. St. Peter's Square is shown with its domed basilica and the obelisk in front of it.
I think that he really came into his own when he was singing in Italian.
Small boats float on the water in a little harbour. There's a group sitting eating on an outside terrace. They're being serenaded by a guitar player. There's a relief stone sculpture of some music. Then gondolas are shown on the Grand Canal in Venice. Gianluca Terranova, tenor.
Mario Lanza's Italian was good. Was a little slang, like the parents in the center of Italy, center south. Sometimes he speak a little Neapolitan.
There's more black and white film of Italy. A white column is shown in front of a church. There are two children on the beach. A man standing at a beach bar. A woman's in the sea in a bikini. A man sitting in a deck chair reading a newspaper. A couple are sunbathing.
He brought all that fabulous burnished Italianate tenor sound to the simplest piece of music and just sang it with his entire heart and soul.
The sound is the language. Where you sing, che gelida manina, is all in the word.
Mario Lanza couldn't read music, which was not all that uncommon in those days. In a way, that made the meaning of the words and the love of the sound that he made even more immediate.
Mario received a lot of criticism in his lifetime, mainly from opera purists who saw the shortcomings in his recordings, the stylistic lapses. And what I think a lot of them failed to realize was those lapses were really due to the fact that he never sang the great roles on stage in their entirety.
Classical purists at that point may have seen him as kind of abdicating from what they might have considered to be the traditional classical operatic route. But you know what? To hell with that.
Critics resented the fact that people who didn't know about opera looked at Mario and said, oh, he's the greatest singer since Caruso.
If Mario had sung an opera, he could be compared to the great tenor of the history. All time.
But it's one thing to sing arias out of context in a concert situation with a microphone. It's another thing to sustain an entire opera in a 2,500-seater theatre with no amplification, projecting for 2 or 3 hours to the back of the hall.
There was so much discipline involved in being an operatic tenor. I don't believe he was ready for that kind of discipline. Knowing him and knowing his zest and his love of life, and I think he really loved doing the movies.
But nothing will ever convince me that Mario Lanza did not have a fully scaled operatic voice. He had a fully developed, fully schooled, world-class operatic tenor that decided to do movies and records.
Mario didn't take critics very seriously at all, because he himself knew that, you know, he was maybe not the most polished singer of grand opera.
This nitpicking from pseudo-critics and pseudo-experts really tires me.
They acknowledged his great achievements, but there was a but, dot, 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 in it.
No one is technically perfect, not even Caruso. I mean, if you read the letters, and I have access to, I think, 800 letters of Caruso, firsthand, your actual original document, He writes to his wife or lover or the mother of his children about all the, you know, the cracks sometimes he had in performances. Mario Lanza technically did nothing wrong.
But when it came to the critics themselves, Mario said, as long as they mention your name and spell it right, that's all that matters. I don't think he lost any sleep. But I know Maria Callas used to fret about bad reviews, which was just heartbreaking.
Well, I don't know what you mean by tempestuous. There's been lots of talk about it, too, and I haven't quite understood what it means.
To see some squirrely little review in a long-forgotten newspaper, it's just heartbreaking to think that she would respond like that.
It isn't always pleasant because I have to live up to so much that it's rather uncomfortable.
Mario didn't. He wanted to be loved and he wanted to give his best. And I think what helped him too was that he never gave a performance where the crowd didn't go absolutely wild.
He steps back from the mic, kisses his hand, and waves.
Do I think it's a pity that he didn't do more opera and more sort of focused opera recordings? Yes. But that's his choice to make, not mine and not anyone else's. But when some critics say that he didn't have a voice or had a small voice, I say this with, I think, some kind of authority after I've been singing for almost 20 years, at the age of 19. I think they don't know what they're talking about. No microphone, no amplifier can give you that quality of sound.
You get an idea of these recordings of Mario Lanza and on film where the walls are literally shaking.
Sammy Kahn, he says, if you've only heard Mario Lanza on disc, you've never heard him at all because, you know, his voice was so spectacular, it scared the hell out of you.
On a jukebox, it says, Mario Lanza, Nessun Dorma. There are black and white photos of Lanza with some of his co-stars, at the piano and backstage. In one, he's dressed as Otello, standing next to a man in a suit. In another, he's being directed on a film set by a bald-headed director who's stretching his hand in front of him. Now he's dressed as Radames, the Egyptian warrior. Now he's backstage in his Otello costume. Then there's a photo of him singing alongside an orchestra.
What the classical music industry may have forgotten, particularly the operatic world, is that maybe some of the greatest opera stars in the world, if you look at maybe Luciano Pavarotti and even Jose Carreras, who could have been influenced from an early age by listening to Lanza, may not have been.
Jerry Hadley, I think, is also on the list, the late Jerry Hadley. And the list goes on and on and on.
He's gone over the top of all the opera singers, because you never hear about many opera singers standing on the shoulders of another one. You don't hear that so much. But everybody seems to be standing on the shoulders of Mario Lanza, which is quite extraordinary.
Everyone says, oh, he never trained, he never had a voice teacher, but he did, he had quite a few. He always took care of the voice. The voice was always very important to him. He always felt it was from God, and he always felt that it was a gift, and he wanted to protect it.
MGM were sort of on the production line. They were just pushing out the movies. They wanted to make as much money off him as they could, and he wanted to basically at that point take a step back and say, listen, guys, I'm making recordings for you. I'm making recordings for my radio show. I'm doing concert tours. I'm recording for RCA. I need a breathing room.
And he had these two films that they wanted him to do, and they wanted him to make them in Italy.
Two men and a woman are looking at headshots in a production office. On the wall is a poster saying Arrivederci Roma. A clapperboard is moved away from in front of the camera to reveal Lanza and his male co-stars squashed into the front of a helicopter. The rotors on the aircraft start to spin as a cameraman films them. Then several production photos are shown, taken during the filming of Arrivederci Roma.
Questa qua,
And I think he wanted to show his children his Italian roots. So Italy seemed a good thing. It seemed like it would be a new start.
Mario looked like Italian because he was born from Italian people. Many Italians don't know that Mario is American.
Arrivederci, Roma. Goodbye, au revoir. Si riveda spasso in carrozzella e ripensa a quella giumagella che era tanto bella e che gli ave...
Mario Lanza's face is Italian face. They look like an Italian person, so I didn't know that he was born in America. So I thought, an Italian in Hollywood is my hero. Fantastic.
He was definitely American, but he loved pasta. And he loved the Italians. It was part of his life. We were in a beautiful home in the Patioli district. And we enjoyed it very much. My mother and father would entertain there quite often. He was happy. He was happy in Rome. I just remember him as being happy. He did not like to be alone. He always felt the more the merrier. He was always like a teenager, so to speak. He just loved to have fun. My father loved Christmas. And he would sing all the Christmas carols.
There's black and white film of a snow-covered garden. A couple walk through a snowy woodland. Then there's a Christmas tree beside a church altar and angel figurines gathered round a crib.
Once we had a party where we had one Christmas tree with the typical tinsel and the bulbs and the lights and all the decorations. And the other tree was with sausages, salami, various cheeses hanging from the tree. Moments like that I remember very clearly.
Black and white film of a Christmassy shop window display. A little girl shakes hands with Santa Claus. There's an enormous Christmas tree lit up with hundreds of lights. A building's decorated with Christmas lights too.
He lived life fast and with great joy and with great passion. And when that became too much, he would crash down a bit, and Betty was there with the love and the support. Betty gave Mario a center to his life.
It was very difficult for her to deal with the fame. And along with the fame, he had his own struggles.
She also gave him four really beautiful children whom he doted on till the day he died.
Around the children, he was always our father. He was always happy and loving and caring, and, you know, his troubles we were not aware of.
I consider myself moral support. I think that's what every wife should be.
The more famous he became, the more difficult it was for her. And she struggled very often with that. So it was a bittersweet marriage at the end. And I think my mother suffered along with him. And she became very depressed.
In one of the letters, it says, Val Parnell's Sunday night at the London Palladium.
He was asked to sing for the Queen at the Royal Variety Show at the London Palladium in November 1957.
I want to introduce to you a star of many opera stages and a great star of Hollywood, Mario Lanza.
Mario arrived in Victoria Station by train. And there was a huge crowd of people mobbing him, cheering, Mario, Mario, we want Mario. The reception and the warmth and the excitement that he was generating was amazing.
Having nearly been mobbed to death by your fans, I have some questions which they have asked me to ask
please.
You. The first is, how long are you going to be in England?
Well, this time only until the 26th of November.
He always regretted that he didn't appear for Her Majesty at the premiere of Because You're Mine, the movie. So he felt this would be his great opportunity to sing that actual song for her live on stage.
Because you're mine.
you'll see the photographs of him afterwards. When Queen Elizabeth got to greet him, she said that she never realized that human lungs could produce such volume. And indeed, to support that comment, when he's going to sing, the microphone goes down to the floor. So he was not a microphone singer in any way. But one of the reviewers for the Palladium concert said that the power of Mr. Lanza's top notes almost tore the roof off the building. Mario gave a conference at the Dorchester Hotel where he was staying with Betty. And again, he looked fantastic. But one of the reporters asked him, "How are you managing your weight, Mr. Lanza?" And he didn't say as much to the interviewer, but he was pretty ticked off. And as he said to Betty afterwards, "Why did they keep asking me about my weight?"
The European tour was booked through April. Valencia!
A European map is shown.
I hear you softly call to me.
But there were cancellations.
There were some that he missed and some that he canceled completely. At times, he did suffer from stage fright. And you wouldn't know it, because the minute he came out on stage, he owned it.
He'd get to the point where maybe everybody's actually already in the theatre, and he'd just say, "No, not doing it tonight, doesn't feel right, I'm off." And he'd just walk out, and everyone would be like, "What?"
For example, before he even arrived in the New Frontier Hotel, Las Vegas, knowing how terrible his publicity was, they were already taking bets that he wouldn't show on the night. And he takes a sedative and he promptly passes out. And then they have to go and tell the management that Mr. Lanza will not be appearing tonight. So it was left to poor Jimmy Durante to go out and say, "Sorry folks, but Mario is really ill."
That backing out could have been the point that where he was being more in tune with himself, that I'm not a puppet that just gets up and does it. And stress to be a performer is stressful, to be backstage waiting to go on, to whether your voice is going to do it or not, to know that you're being relied upon.
High blood pressure, gout, and phlebitis were just some of the ailments that afflicted him.
He had a point where the touring, the concert tours in Europe, became more difficult for him. He drank a little too much.
Mario Lanza wasn't like the angel that we all believed him to be. Lee Milazzo wrote, "Lanza lived a life of excess. He drank so constantly and so heavily that he was usually uncontrollably and frequently unconscious. He ate such binges, not even his 50-inch chest and his 19-inch neck could hold the pounds."
I was born 10 years after the end of the war, but even then there was a kind of daredevil sense in society. We're going to risk things, we're going to be daredevil, and we're not going to worry about the consequences. I get the sense he was caught up perhaps in that.
In Germany, Mario was seen by a doctor, and the doctor pointedly warned Mario that unless you change your lifestyle, you know, one day you're going to suffer a clot and die.
Following his failure to appear in Hamburg, the tenor retreated to Rome to recuperate and began preparations for work on his next film, for the first time.
Mario retreated to Rome and to basically get control of his life again, to diet and do some exercise.
There are photos of Lanza and a young Zsa Zsa Gabor smiling together.
For the First Time was released in 1959. Lanza was singing better than ever.
For the first time, for the first time.
But the mighty voice gave the lie to the true state of his health. He was hospitalized several times that year and cautioned repeatedly by his doctors.
We've got so much information today about the medical science now that has shown us our arteries are very important. You know, they can close up any time. Calcification of the arteries, all these sort of things weren't really, really discovered so deeply at that time.
It wasn't uncommon. It was the precursor to a lot of other people who lived at a similar pace. Presley himself ended up a little like Mario Lanza. Many others in the 60s. Followed Mario Lanza. It was as if he opened a bit of a floodgate.
Lanza's London agent, John Coast, implored the singer to change his ways in a letter dated 29th January 1958. Dear Mario, we must face together how to solve your personal problems, because even you can't expect to punish your own body much longer.
Mario shrugged it off and said, you know, I'm fit as a bull. I can handle it. I just had a slight sore throat last night.
He had a cane. He had a limp. He had what you call phlebitis. But we were planning to stay in Rome for a longer period of time. So there were plans. There were great plans.
Mario would go in to these health farms and they'd put them on these starvation diets where they'd be in there and they'd drip them up and sort of keep fluid in their bodies, but they wouldn't eat and they'd lose weight incredibly quickly. And then he'd go out and he'd do a movie or a performance, nice and slim, and then over it put the weight back on and then he'd go back in. That's going to take its toll on your vital organs.
The phlebitis started to act up. And he was asked to go into the Valle Giulia clinic. In the morning, he was just fine. He had spoken to my mother, and he was going to come home that afternoon. And he died, just like that, just suddenly, in an instant. And I believe that a blood clot went straight to his heart.
Terry turned on the radio, and he heard "Be My Love" being sung, and he said, "Oh, it's Mario on the radio." And then the announcer stepped in and said that was the voice of the late Mario Lanza, who died suddenly in Rome.
Just after midday on Wednesday, 7th October 1959, Mario Lanza suffered a heart attack and died shortly afterwards. America's voice from the gods was no more.
It sent shockwaves throughout the world. Richard Moore, Mario's opera producer at RCA, said, "I was deeply, deeply shocked and deeply saddened." He said, "But when I thought about it for a moment, I wasn't surprised."
If he'd have looked after himself, and maybe if he'd have had people around that would have been looking after him as well, I think we would have potentially seen a lot more of Mario Lanza.
I walk with God.
There's black and white film of mourners gathered outside a gate. Some mourners are being let through in single file. A dark-haired woman is among those waiting. A crowd are gathered outside a church. The mourners leave the church. More people join the crowd. Mrs. Lanza, dressed in black, is led away in tears. The coffin's in a horse-drawn carriage, behind which there's a line of dark cars. There's a little boy in the crowd lining the route as the funeral procession continues slowly onwards.
I remember they had brought my father home, his body, and they laid it out in the living room. And my sister, she went around to the living room window and peeked in. And she said, "Daddy's laying down. He's in a casket." And then Colleen and I knew.
He had a funeral in Rome, and they shipped his body down to his hometown of Philadelphia. And even there, tragedy was stalking him, because one lady walking past the casket looked at him, had a major heart attack, and dropped dead on the spot.
Oh, the funeral director stayed up all night with a shotgun, because there were 15, 20,000 people in line waiting to see his body. And from then, we came to California, where we had another funeral. So there were three funerals. And by that time, my mother was she just about had fallen apart. She couldn't handle, she couldn't understand. She never was the same after that. She never came out of it.
When he died, she just seemed to lose the will to live, which, when you consider that she had these four really beautiful children, must seem really shocking to a lot of people today.
One day, my Uncle Terry picked the four of us up from school, and we went straight to the Pacific Palisades, where my grandparents, my father's parents, had a home. And there we discovered my mother had passed away. And we always say, from a broken heart, because her heart was broken.
She was 37 years old, and 5 months after her husband was gone, they found her dead in bed.
It wasn't that she woke up one day and said, I'm going to kill myself. It just was a long 5 month period of very, very deep, deep depression. And dealing with it with pills, which doctors gave her. So we went to live with my grandparents. And for the next 10 years, she raised us with my grandfather and my Uncle Terry Robinson. But I rarely saw her smile after that.
And that's really where Terry Robinson stepped up to the plate, because he was there for them like the father they now didn't have.
Terry Robinson took each one of us home from the hospital when we were born. My father didn't like to drive, so it was always Uncle Terry who drove. He just loved my father. He loved him like a brother. I always called him Uncle Terry till the day he died. He was dedicated to our family, and he never left. Never left. Guardian
angels around. There's a photo of Lanza and Terry shaking hands in front of a car. Joining me in my prayer.
57 years ago, this very month, the world was given the sad news of the loss of one of the greatest voices of the century. But tonight, through our performers, that voice lives on.
Thrilled by the wonder of you and the wonderful touch of your...
Geraldine McCann approached me. She reminded me that Mario Lanza was 50 years dead 7 years ago, and that a show would work really well.
This is the result of it now, 7 years later, and there's over 20 concerts nationwide.
But come ye back when summer's in the mare.
We tell a story every night, so it doesn't matter how much you know about Mario Lanza or you don't know. Once you leave here, you know all about his life.
The hall seats 1,200 people, and it's been sold out every time.
The performers indicate the orchestra behind them on stage.
As everybody knows, Because and The Loveliest Night of the Year, O Sole Mio, and the great big ones. But really, for me, it's Without a Song. I think it's the lyric, you know. Without a song, the day means nothing.
Without a song.
It was a great buzz, naturally, for everybody the first time that she came over, being the only remaining child of Mario Lanza.
I can't tell you how wonderful it is to be back here at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. This tribute brings back so many wonderful memories and some sad ones, too. But I'm always reminded of my father's enduring legacy, which he has left for all of us.
He came from a community where music was at its heart, and you can hear that in every sound he makes. And he was the one that made me realise that that's what I needed for myself, that I had to have a life where music was absolutely at the core of who I am. And I will always thank him for that.
He's important for tenors like me, that thanks to him, we wanted to become tenors.
The opera is for young people, for old people, for everybody. And Mario is the example.
There are many great artists, many great, great singers. But I have never seen anyone quite like him.
It's a career that lives on, and a legacy that I think is indestructible.
You could spend your whole life training and not have those chops.
He was able to phrase, use his voice in such a specific way that touched just about everyone who listened to him.
And when you saw him on screen, you just couldn't help but love him.
I don't think there'll ever be another Lanza.
Mario Lanza remains the greatest romantic tenor of the 20th century. He delivered his promise and gave us the best of everything.
It all came from his heart. It all came from the man himself. It wasn't just something he had to do to make a living. He had to sing to live. That was the difference.
There's black and white film of Lanza walking through a car park, accompanied by a man in glasses who's holding a notebook. Mario smiling and chatting. There's a photo of Mario and Betty with fishing rods over their shoulders. A photo of Mario with his arms around his four kids. Then Mario and Betty holding hands with their children. There's black and white film of Mario winking. The film freezes on his smile. The end.
Golden days, full of gaiety and full of truth. In our hearts, we remember them all else above. Golden days, days of youth and love. How we laughed with a joy that only love can bring. Looking back through memories, we will know life has nothing sweeter than